Hey everyone, I'd like to take a minute to talk to you all about the upcoming Unforgivables deep dive and bonus Q&A on the Stereo app. Just follow the link in my show notes to join the Unforgivables, Saturdays and Sundays live at 12 p.m. Eastern Time for discussions and behind-the-scenes segments. We'll go through the process and talk about all things podcasting and share some tips and tricks on producing great content. All you have to do is download the Stereo app to hear the live discussions, and you can even be a part of the conversation. With uncensored opinions and exclusive content, we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Maybe you have an idea for a new episode, or a juicy piece of information on one of these cases to share, or maybe you're just one of those people who listen to a show and scream your opinions into the abyss, hoping we can hear you. Well, now we can. Just follow the link in my show notes to join the Unforgivables on Stereo so we can talk directly to you about all things podcasting and, of course, true crime.
Play your emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my God. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both people. I'll never make it to heaven.
Perpetrators of murders don't usually call 911 on themselves. Neither do they beg to be caught. But Paul Michael Stefani, the weepy voice killer, did just that. And then he would do it over and over again. In the early 1980s, Minnesota law enforcement would be plagued by a series of bizarre and anonymous 911 calls. Confessions of murder given by the high-pitched, panicked voice of a man who was viciously murdering women around Minneapolis and St. Paul, an area also known as the Twin Cities. He expressed panic in his calls. He screamed and cried through tears for authorities to catch him before he could kill again. Yet, as remorseful as the voice on the other end of those 911 calls sounded, the weepy voice killer never turned himself in. And between late 1980 and August of 1982, three women would be murdered, and two others brutally attacked and almost beaten to death before the weepy voice killer would finally be crying behind bars. One of 10 children, Stefani was born on September 8, 1944, and raised on a 5-acre plot of land just outside of Austin, Minnesota. As soon as he was old enough to speak, Paul Michael Stefani, along with the rest of his brothers and sisters, were taken to church each weekend. It was a ritual more than a celebration for Stefani's mother, who instilled the doctrines of sin, confession, and absolution into the minds of her children, ensuring they took root. His parents divorced when Stefani was just a toddler. His mother would then remarry by the time he was just 3 years old. But his mother's new husband was just as devout and devoted to the church as she was. However, the kids didn't just gain a father figure. They gained a father to fear. If any of his new stepchildren made him angry, their new father was known to strike out with a hard hit to the head or even throw the kids tumbling down the stairs. After graduating high school in the early 1960s, Paul Michael Stefani left the family home outside of Austin and headed 100 miles north to the city of St. Paul. Aimless, yet independent, Stefani would later hold a string of temporary jobs, including a shipping clerk and a hospital janitor. And then, by the mid-1970s, Stefani had seemingly found stability, marrying a woman by the name of Beverly Leiter and securing full-time employment at the Malmberg Manufacturing Company in St. Paul. The newlyweds also welcomed a child, a daughter. Life was finally good for Paul Michael Stefani and his family in the mid-1970s, but then it wasn't. And no one is exactly sure why. Slowly, though, his marriage started to crumble. The details remain scarce, but Beverly was eventually granted a divorce, and she and her daughter moved away from the home the one-time happy family once shared. Stefani would receive another blow in 1977 when he was fired from his job at the Malmberg Manufacturing Company. Now, living alone, unemployed, and aimless once again, Stefani started to develop what would become a history of mental illness, hearing voices in his head. It didn't get any better for Paul Michael Stefani during the mid-1970s, as he found himself one night being fingerprinted and having his mugshot taken as he was booked for and eventually convicted of aggravated assault. The end of the 1970s came, and with the end of the decade came a blossoming new romance. Paul Michael Stefani met a new woman. She was from Syria, and they eventually began a relationship. However, it didn't last long, because in 1980, Stefani's new girlfriend returned to Syria to accept an arranged marriage. And then, in that same year, A woman was found beaten almost to death beside the railroad tracks near the Malmberg Manufacturing Company, the very same company that fired Stefani. Blood from her head was seeping heavily into the snow, and she had been bludgeoned so badly that her skull had cracked open and her brains were exposed to the cold night air. He would later remember, killing was, seemed to me, the thing you were supposed to do that was part of life. Driving a car was part of life. Eating food was a part of life. To me, it seemed the killing was a part of life, until I did it. But why? Why did he do it? Did the weepy voice killer attack and murder because the voices in his head made him do it? Or did an abused boy become a violent offender? Was a grown Stefani taking out his childhood rage against his strict religious mother by savagely attacking innocent women? What made Paul Michael Stefani, the weepy voice killer, get into his car that December night around 1 a.m., intent on finding a woman to beat with his tire iron? On December 31st, 1980, the three Potak sisters attended a New Year's Eve party in the Twin Cities area. They were on University Avenue, the street that divides St. Paul, the state's capital, and Minneapolis, its largest city. Yet, while the three sisters arrived together, one of them, university student Karen Potak, left alone. Just after 1 a.m. and without a jacket and below freezing temperatures, Karen left the party in search of the bar she and her sisters were at earlier in the night. With a champagne flute still in hand, Karen hurriedly ducked into a deserted alleyway intent on taking a shortcut. Well, almost deserted. A man was also driving through the alleyway and slowed down beside the shivering girl. He rolled down the passenger side window and leaned over. The heater was on, the car was nice and warm. He could give her a ride to anywhere she wanted to go. And so, she got into his car.
Yes, please, this is an emergency. Please send a squad to Pierce Butler Road, Malmberg Manufacturing Company, machine shop. Please, there's an ambulance too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
Just hurry, she's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the engine. Hurry.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you?
Just after 3 a.m., police found the grotesquely beaten and naked body of Karen Potak laying next to the railroad tracks behind the Malmberg Manufacturing Company in North St. Paul. Karen had been repeatedly bludgeoned over the head 10 times with a tire iron, yet, miraculously, she was still alive. While Karen survived the attack, however, she had sustained multiple brain injuries as a result of her cracked skull and exposed brain matter and could not identify her attacker. There was no physical evidence left at the scene, and there were no witnesses. Karen was then taken to the hospital where her injuries were deemed so heinous that police classified the crime as attempted murder. And even after repeated questioning by the police, though, Karen Potak would have no memory of the vicious New Year's Eve attack and could not put a face to her attacker. Eventually, winter turned into spring, and then summer began to settle over the North Star State. The attempted murder of a young woman by tire iron in St. Paul was all but forgotten in the press. For police, it was quickly becoming a cold case. And then, another woman would make her way into the capital city. Yet, she wouldn't make it out. 18-year-old Kimberly Compton, Kim to friends, bought a bus ticket in her hometown of Pepin, Wisconsin, a small town with a population of less than 1,000 people. Like many other high school graduates with dreams of starting the next chapter of life in the city, Kim boarded a Greyhound bus on June 3, 1981, and headed north. Kim stepped off the Greyhound in St. Paul and rented locker number 715 at the bus depot where she would leave both her bags. Excited yet hungry after the 70-odd mile bus ride, Kim wanted to get something to eat before exploring the sights and sounds of her new home. Kim slipped the locker key in her pocket and looked around for somewhere to eat. Directly across the road from the bus depot, she noticed Mickey's Diner and a sign for their barbecue beef and fries special. Kim wasn't the only one eating in the diner that day. A few booths down from where she was enjoying her barbecue beef and fries, a man sat and noticed a fresh-faced young girl. Paul Michael Stefani got up from his seat and walked over to Kim Compton, striking up a conversation. Kim tells the balding yet friendly stranger that she had just arrived and doesn't know her way around yet. Stefani then offers to drive Kim around the city and give a private tour of all the cool local places that she would never find on a tourist map. In fact, he knew a great spot where Kim might get a spectacular view of the famous Mississippi River. And so, excited, Kim eagerly accepts the offer and they leave together. 18-year-old Kimberly Compton didn't know that her first meal in her new zip code, that barbecue beef and fries special at Mickey's Diner, would also be her last.
Oh, you finally, I just stabbed somebody with an ice pick. I can't stop myself. I keep killing somebody.
Hey everyone, I'd like to take a minute to talk to you all about the upcoming Unforgivables deep dive and bonus Q&A on the Stereo app. Just follow the link in my show notes to join the Unforgivables, Saturdays and Sundays live at 12 p.m. Eastern Time for discussions and behind-the-scenes segments. We'll go through the process and talk about all things podcasting and share some tips and tricks on producing great content. All you have to do is download the Stereo app to hear the live discussions, and you can even be a part of the conversation. With uncensored opinions and exclusive content, we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Maybe you have an idea for a new episode, or a juicy piece of information on one of these cases to share, or maybe you're just one of those people who listen to a show and scream your opinions into the abyss, hoping we can hear you. Well, now we can. Just follow the link in my show notes to join the Unforgivables on Stereo so we can talk directly to you about all things podcasting and, of course, true crime. A group of teenage boys would find the dead body of Kimberly Compton by an unfinished section of the interstate just south of St. Paul. The Mississippi River rushed by the secluded area where her bloodied corpse was found, face down, stabbed 61 times with an ice pick. At first, law enforcement thought the 911 call was a prank, but when the weepy voice killer said he killed someone with an ice pick, police knew it wasn't a joke, because who else would know that detail other than the killer? The police had never revealed that information with the media. Police found no identification on the body, but they did discover that key to locker 715 at the Greyhound bus station. Police eventually discovered the bags in the locker and were able to identify their victim as 18-year-old Kimberly Compton of Pepin, Wisconsin. From there, police were able to piece together Kim's movement from the bus depot to the diner. But after questioning staff and inspecting the scene, investigators found no physical evidence or witnesses. They had no leads to chase, no one to suspect. And then, they got another call.
Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to stab her. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every night. I can't believe it. It's just like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'll kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else.
Investigators couldn't seem to connect anyone to the weepy voice confessing to Kim Compton's murder on the other end of calls made to the police. They could, however, connect the voice with another 911 call made months earlier. The call that had alerted police to that hurt girl by the railroad tracks. Realizing they now had the makings of a serial killer on their hands, police turned to the public for help. As most of the world was captivated with catching a glimpse of England's newly wedded Princess Diana and Prince Charles, investigators in Minnesota were hoping to catch a killer. The St. Paul police released part of the 911 tape in hopes someone would recognize the voice of a killer. Law enforcement in the Twin Cities were flooded with over 100 phone calls. Yet, they were no closer to identifying the man who would kill and then call to confess. And then, almost 9 months later, on March 9, 1982, former detective Earl Mills came out of a retirement for one day, convinced they finally had a breakthrough in the Weepy Voice killer case.
Locally tonight, St. Paul police are disappointed. They thought they were close to solving one of the city's murders, but new information has sent the police back to square one in the murder case of Kimberly Compton. That information came to light when police took a rare step and opened their files to the media. Lindsay Strand has more on the story.
Retired St. Paul Detective Earl Mills returned to the force for one day this week to open the files of his seven-month investigation to the media. He said he was convinced information received 4 days after he retired last February answered the question of who killed Kimberly Compton. Mills believed it was Alan Lopez, indicted for killing his parents and sister at their St. Paul home last August. Found mentally incompetent to stand trial, Lopez was sent to the State Security Hospital in St. Peter, where he committed suicide before police could talk to him. But while barricaded inside his family's house last summer, he had confessed to killing Compton. Police, however, had ruled him out as a suspect because they linked the Compton murder to another case they didn't believe Lopez could have committed. The link was in taped telephone calls to police. Kimberly Compton's body was discovered last June along an unfinished portion of 35E, only 3.5 hours after she arrived in town by bus.
Lopez had not been the Weepy Voice killer after all. "I'll never make it to heaven," the Weepy Voice killer had mourned on one particular phone call to police. The emotional cry came on the tail of another confession of murder, because it seemed as though the Weepy Voice killer's calls always came down to the sacrament of penance. Confession, however, can happen for many reasons. A weary conscience, heavy thoughts, or even genuine remorse. For some people, though, confessing their sins is just a way to relive the experience over and over again. Otherwise, why did the Weepy Voice killer not turn himself in after he nearly beat Karen Potak to death on that New Year's Eve night? Over a year later, on July 21st, 1981, 33-year-old Kathleen Greening from St. Paul was scheduled to go on vacation to Mackinac Island with her best friend, Carol Kellogg. Carol drove over to her friend's house to have breakfast before they left for the airport. Her knock to the door, however, went unanswered. Carol tested the knob and found it unlocked. So, she let herself in. Carol called out for a friend, but those calls too went unanswered. Growing uneasy now, she began methodically entering each room in her friend's small home, continuing to call out her name. Maybe she had headphones in. Maybe she was taking a nap. Carol stopped in her tracks, though, when she noticed the bathroom door partially open with the light on. And then Carol Kellogg realized why her friend wasn't answering her calls. Kathleen Greening was dead in her bathtub. Her naked body was face up in the water, with her head under the tap, her knees bent toward the front of the tub. Kathleen's almost porcelain body showed no signs of an attack, leaving police to initially rule her death as an accidental drowning. This time, however, Stefani didn't attempt to contact the police about the killing. This episode was brought to you by Best Fiends. I want to take a minute to talk to you about Best Fiends. With so much going on these days, Best Fiends has really become my go-to when I want to relax and unwind, and also have some fun playing with friends and family. And it's become a cool challenge for us, seeing who can level up the fastest and collect the most characters. Best Fiends is free to download, and it will never feel like it's getting old because there are literally thousands of levels and new in-game challenges added every month, so it stays fresh. And for all of you out there into solving puzzles and flexing those brain muscles, then you definitely won't be disappointed. It's just a relaxing way to have some fun. With over 100 million downloads and a 5-star rating, it's no wonder Best Fiends has become so popular. Best Fiends has created a whole entire world on your mobile device, and with so many cool levels, the game just keeps on getting better the further along you get. And for those times you don't have Wi-Fi, don't worry about it. You can play the game without Wi-Fi, which comes in handy. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. By August of 1982, police had linked the attempted murder of Karen Potak by the tire iron in Minneapolis with the murder of Kimberly Compton by Ice Pick in St. Paul. Yet, both cases were growing colder and colder by the day. Carol Kellogg and her friend, Kathleen, never made their flight, and Kathleen's death was yet to be linked to the madman the media dubbed the Weepy Voice Killer. And then, on August 6th, a paperboy found the dead body of a woman on his paper route. The corpse was held down by brush on an embankment along the Mississippi River. She had been stabbed over 100 times. Barbara Simons, a 40-year-old nurse, deserved a night out. She took herself to the Hexagon Bar in Minneapolis, where she danced, drank, and met a man. He had asked for an extra cigarette, and Barbara obliged. "I hope he's a nice guy," she had said to the bartender as she ordered another drink. "He's giving me a ride home." Soon after, Barbara got in the car, and then another 911 call was made.
"Fire emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry, I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my God. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both of you. I'm sorry. I'll never make it to heaven."
Loved ones helped police trace Barbara's steps to the Hexagon Bar. The bartender who served Barbara that beer told investigators that she had been with a white man, bordering on overweight with a dark, receding hairline. Police dug through recent mugshots of offenders with a history of violent assault in the Twin Cities, eventually narrowing them down to an 8-photo lineup based on the witness suspect's description. He was described as being around 40 years old, 6 feet tall and 185 pounds. The witness said he had a dark complexion and receding black hair. The bartender, who had last served a hopeful Barbara Simons, was able to identify the man as Paul Michael Stefani, the same man who had a previous conviction for aggravated assault in the 70s and had his fingerprints and mugshot taken. Now digging into his background, authorities discovered Paul Michael Stefani had worked at the Malmberg Manufacturing Company, where Karen Potak had been found with her brains exposed through a cracked skull. Stefani soon became the main suspect in Barbara Simons' murder, and police set up a surveillance team on his apartment. It was hot on the night of August 21, 1981, when Paul Michael Stefani pulled out of his apartment parking lot in St. Paul. Investigators digging out the suspected murderer of Barbara Simon were able to trail Stefani to Minneapolis, yet they eventually lost track. And as a result, another woman would almost lose her life.
She got in my car and I gave her my jacket and told her, I said, he'll be out in a minute. I had to clean some of the ice off the windshield.
Do you remember where you hit her with the tire iron, Paul? Did you hit her one time, two times?
Must have been about 30 times, but I mean, I good 20 times, I didn't know.
Were you swinging it this way, or did you poke her with it?
I don't think I poked her. No. I remember it hit her mainly on the forehead, on the cheek, and the jaw, and the mouth. The top of the head. I think it was only about 10 times, but then I know she must really be hurting in that, you know, steel bar like that.
The foot traffic in the red light district of Minneapolis was scarce when 19-year-old sex worker Denise Williams was approached by a man in a car. The two arranged a price for her services, $100 to have some fun. He only had $40 on him at the time, but it was okay. They could get the other $60 when he drove her back. The man leaned over and opened the car door, and Denise got in.
I was even hurt when I went back to the car. There, there's going like this. I mean, and that's what I made me want to go to the phone. I mean, I really wanted to help her. My mind started clearing up. What are you doing? You had a chance to make another friend. I kept yelling at myself. Dude, you like to make friends.
The two went back to Paul Michael Stefani's apartment, where they had sex. It was over rather quickly, and Denise had assumed that her John would want to have some more fun. He didn't. Instead, he abruptly offered to drive her back into the city. Stefani began to chit-chat and make small talk as they started the short drive back to the red light district. It didn't take long, though, for Denise to notice that he was taking them farther and farther away from the city. Then, Denise had noticed the man turning onto a dead-end road, driving through the dark. He stopped the car. A sex worker since she was 13, Denise Williams felt the beginnings of unease creep over her skin, and her instincts began to take over. Fearing her life was in danger, Denise's eyes covertly darted around the interior of the car in search of a weapon. Luckily, she spotted a glass bottle lying on the floor. "Ass, grass, or gas," he said. "No one rides for free." Denise tried the handle of the door, yet Stefani grabbed her by the arm and suddenly lunged. 19-year-old Denise Williams would be stabbed multiple times with a screwdriver before she was able to process what was happening to her and reach down to grip that glass bottle in her hand. She brought it up over her head and smashed it into the face of her attacker, glass shards gouging the side of his face, chest, and hand. Denise was able to then scramble out of the passenger side of the car, falling onto the ground. Painfully exhausted and unable to punch, kick, and bite any longer, Denise tried a different tactic as she schooled her body to lay still. "I'm dying, I'm dying," she had moaned, in an attempt to fake her death, in hopes the man would let up and leave her to die. But it didn't work. Stefani kept attempting to stick the screwdriver as deep and hard into his victim as he could. Eventually, Denise's screams would attract the attention of resident Douglas Penning, who lived in the isolated suburb. The Good Samaritan had heard her cries for help and left his apartment to investigate. Douglas came upon a man on top of a woman, attempting to stab her. Yet when he tried to peel Stefani off, the killer turned his weapon on him, even giving chase when Douglas ran away. As Douglas Penning made it back to the safety of his apartment to call the police, a badly injured Paul Michael Stefani scurried back into his car. Sirens appeared in minutes. Stefani was long gone, yet Denise Williams was taken to the hospital. She had received 15 stab wounds to her chest, abdomen, and head, as well as punctured lung and liver. But Denise survived the horrific and brutal attack. Initially, because she was on probation at the time of the attack, Denise would tell police that her name was Mary and that she was hitchhiking when she got into the man's car. Eventually, however, she came clean and admitted to the truth. Later, that same night, Douglas Penning placed a hurried 911 call to report the attack on Denise Williams. And across the city, another familiar voice would also place a 911 call.
Can you hear an ambulance?
Where?
1505 Westminster.
1505?
Yeah.
Westminster, what's the problem?
I'm all cut up. I got beat up.
What's your apartment number?
208, I'm bleeding.
208, where are you bleeding from?
From my arm, my face, my head.
An ambulance was quickly dispatched to the caller, but the sirens heard along Westminster Street leading to the apartment of 37-year-old Paul Michael Stefani didn't just belong to the paramedics. Police cruisers were also rushing to the address because the voice was one Twin City law enforcement recognized. It belonged to the man in the mugshot, the man who police were surveilling earlier on that evening before they lost track of his vehicle. The same man who left Hexagon Bar on that night in August with Barbara Simons, the man they already suspected of murder. Paul Michael Stefani was arrested and taken into police custody at the St. Paul Police Precinct. Denise Williams quickly and confidently picked out his mugshot. He was then officially charged with her attempted murder, and investigators were able to piece together the similarities in the attacks on Denise Williams and Karen Potak, and the murders of Kimberly Compton and Barbara Simons, all in the Twin Cities area. During interrogation, police showed a sweaty and nervous Stefani crime scene photos of all four women. It was then that his agitation suddenly grew, rising to a fever pitch that sent the sweat trickling down his neck. Visibly shaken, a high-pitched, panicked voice vowed to his interrogators that, "You're not gonna pin those on me." Paul Michael Stefani did not confess to his sins. Detective Brown, who was part of the interrogation, related that Stefani got up from his seat and his voice immediately changed. And right away it struck me as the same voice that I heard on those recordings. The police just had to prove it. Along with the attempted murder of Denise Williams, Stefani would also stand trial for the murder of Barbara Simons, both of which took place in Minneapolis, a different jurisdiction from where the attempt on Karen Potak and the murder of Kimberly Compton occurred in St. Paul. Stefani would plead not guilty to the murders of Barbara Simons, and the audio recordings of the calls he placed to police after her murders would be compared to the recordings of all the calls he placed after the Denise Williams attack. Stefani would plead not guilty to the murder of Barbara Simons, and the audio recordings of the calls he placed to police after her murder would be compared to the recordings of the call he placed after the Denise Williams attack during the trial. Experts would testify that the voice of Stefani was remarkably similar to the weepy voice killer, but they could not conclusively say that they were a direct match. And then, his sister was called to the stand. After being played one of the weepy voice killer's confessions to the police, Stefani's sister bowed her head and admitted that she had no doubt the voice on the other end of that 911 call belonged to her brother. His ex-wife and a previous girlfriend would also testify they believed the hysterical caller was Stefani. It was also revealed during the trial that Stefani's ex-wife was one of those concerned citizens who placed a call to police when the news media released one of the weepy voice killer's 911 calls. She pointed the finger at her ex-husband. Then, there was no follow-up. After a six-week trial, Paul Michael Stefani was found guilty for the murder of Barbara Simon and sentenced to 40 years in prison. He would go on to plead not guilty to the attempted murder of Denise Williams. And the case would go to trial, where Stefani would again be found guilty and receive an additional 18 years. When reporters spoke to Stefani after his conviction, he told them that he would hear voices telling him to kill. "There was somebody telling me, Paul, it's time to kill." He said during the killing of Kathleen Greening, he felt like he was playing a game. He would be smiling and a few seconds later ask himself, "What are you doing? She's dying." He himself didn't understand why he would pick up someone at a bar and 15 minutes later would stab them. With the convictions on the Simons and Williams cases in Minneapolis, an obvious assumption would be that prosecutors in St. Paul would be quick to build their case against the weepy voice killer for the attack on Karen Potak and the murder of Kimberly Compton. Yet, that wouldn't be an accurate assessment. Instead, prosecutors deemed the audio recordings of the weepy voice killer to be too distorted to pursue a conviction. So, as of 1982, the attempted murder of Karen Potak and the killing of Kimberly Compton remain unsolved, and the bathtub drowning of Kathleen Greening was still considered an accident. And then, 12 years later, the weepy voice killer would contact the St. Paul police one last time. Paul Michael Stefani was finally ready to confess. In 1997, Stefani was diagnosed with cancer while serving his sentences, police met with him at the Oak Park Heights prison in Minnesota, where he confessed to the murders of Kim Compton, Barbara Simons, and Kathleen Greening. Investigators would then revisit the case file on Kathleen Greening. It would lead to the discovery of her day planner and an entry with the name Paul S. A number was listed beside it, the same phone number Paul Michael Stefani called 911 from after Denise Williams smashed and sliced him with that broken bottle, eventually saving her life. And so, justice was finally served for those three women from St. Paul. The Weepy Voice killer died in the Oak Park prison from cancer in 1998. He was serving 58 years for 2 counts of attempted murder and 3 counts of murder. But no one will ever know if Paul Michael Stefani's last confession got him into heaven.